Our last case this morning is 2019-184, State of Ohio versus Mitchell Hartman. Sitting in for Justice Stewart is Judge Lisa Sadler from the 10th District Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge. Mr. Fry, or excuse me, Ms.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, Associate Justices, and may it please the Court. My name is Mary Fry, and I'm an Assistant Prosecuting Attorney in Cuyahoga County, and I represent the State of Ohio in this matter. Sitting at Appellant's Counsel table also with me are my colleagues, Assistant Prosecutors Daniel Van and Maxwell Martin. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. The State is respectfully requesting that this Honorable Court reverse the 8th District's decision in this matter because the other act's evidence, as the trial court found, was probative of Mr. Hartman's intent, motive, and plan. And
which one?
Well, Your Honor, it can be offered for more than one purpose.
Well, Well, walk me through how it's. I mean, they seem to be kind of thrown together, and there seem to be a moving target in this case. So, if it's all three of those, explain how it works for all three.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think I would like to first address, if I may, the comment that it was thrown together regarding putting all of them together.
It was kind of a moving target, right? I mean, the State argued different things at different times.
I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, because I think when you first look at the evolution of the notice with the 404B, which provides, I would agree with you, Your Honor, identity, intent, motive, plan, absence of mistake. A notice is just that, a notice. And at that point in time, Your Honor, the State did not know, as indicated in its notice of intent to use 404B evidence, what the defense was going to be presented at trial. As part of that notice, it discusses how, if the defense is consent, that intent, motive would be rebutting that. Identity goes to if they're claiming, the defense is claiming, I wasn't there or it didn't happen.
How would it ever possibly be for identity?
I think if Mr. Hartman said that I was not the perpetrator, that it would go to identity.
So, you could introduce that he allegedly assaults when 8 years would show his identity in that case?
Well, I think that would would go to
this kind of his behavioral footprint, because
yes, Your Honor, and I think
because
that's
he has sexually assaulted someone.
Well, no, it's not that there's two sexual assaults, Your Honor, in both cases. It's the nature in which Mr. Hartman approaches the victims and how he approaches the offense. So I think what's really important to focus on in this case is the manner in which Mr. Hartman approaches the victims. Mr. Hartman, in his brief, discusses how it's one in a hotel room and one in a bedroom in his own home. But what needs to be focused on is Mr. Hartman knowing that a victim is asleep and targeted.
How did he know he was asleep before she got in the room? Was there any evidence he knew she was asleep?
Yes, absolutely. I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you.
Was there any evidence he knew she was asleep?
Yes, there was circumstantial evidence that he knew that she was asleep, and also
which was what?
The surveillance video when the victim is leaving the bar to go back to the hotel with her boyfriend. There was evidence with the surveillance video that he was there when she said, "I'm going back to go to sleep," that they were going to potentially meet up at a casino later, the boyfriend who was going to leave the victim at the hotel room, and also that as they left, Your Honor, Mr. Hartman was the one, the surveillance video focuses on this, was the one that is watching them leave the bar and go back to the hotel room. And then also, Your Honor, when he approaches the hotel clerk, the front desk receptionist, he says, "I need to have a key to get into the hotel room, the specific hotel room that he knows that the victim is sleeping in, because I need to retrieve my bag." And they say, "No, you're not authorized to get into that room and to receive a key because you're not one of the guests listed." So he calls one of the friends that's out with the boyfriend who had walked the victim back to the hotel room. And the boyfriend is with the friend that he calls. So he knows that the victim is alone, Your Honor, and asleep at that point. So there was a lot of evidence introduced that Mr. Hartman knew that the victim was asleep when he approached that room.
And you think that's enough for the evidence to come in to show identity, that there were, that someone allegedly assaulted two people who were asleep? That's a behavioral footprint.
Well, I think that identity wasn't at issue in this case, Your Honor. But I'm trying to explain, Your Honor, that If it was offered for identity, yes, I think that is important to show, because if Mr. Hartman is saying that he was not there, that it was someone else who committed the act, that would be evidence to show MO and plan, especially because of the fact that it's close in time, Your Honor.
Just pick out one of these, whichever one you think is the best, and tell me your best argument why it applies to that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Motive and intent. And the reason, and I think it's important to focus on the fact that the 8th District opinion in this case only focused on the two rape counts that Mr. Hartman was convicted of. There was also evidence that needed to be presented for the kidnapping count that had a sexual motivation specification, and also the burglary count, which had trespass with the intent to commit a rape.
So it goes to motive and intent because why?
I would say for motive, we needed to prove the sexual motivation specification for kidnapping and his motive in entering the room, Your Honor.
So under that logic, anytime there's evidence of, in a rape case, of any kind of prior sexual assault, that has to come in because that shows the motive.
No, Your Honor.
What is special about this case?
Because of the fact that he is approaching sleeping victims in their sleeping quarters where they're alone and vulnerable and easily able to isolate and control. I think, Your Honor,
So you're saying that it's admissible for motive because it shows that he is sexually attracted, that his motivation was sexual, right?
Yes, but also it's to show sexual motivation that when he entered the room that he wanted to sexually assault the victim,
Your Honor, any prior sexual assault would be, by anyone in any case, would be admissible.
No, Your Honor, because, and I think this also falls into what the 8th District said in their opinion, that sexual gratification is inherent in almost any sexual assault, and that finding by the 8th District to reject the motive in this case has also been used in two other cases in the 8th District since then. And I think what it confuses is the fact that if you say that sexual gratification or sexual motivation in any case is inherent, then we never have to prove sexual motivation when you're restraining an individual for the kidnapping count.
Are you saying that the prior evidence mimics what happened in this allegation to such an extent that that's why it should have been allowed in?
Yes, because of the fact that you have two sleeping victims that he knew were going to be asleep and alone and vulnerable. And I think...
So it was his MO to commit these assaults in this particular manner?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and so let's talk about the first offense that was allowed in this particular case. He was charged with going into... not an adult, like this case, but into a minor's bedroom.
Correct, Your Honor.
Stepdaughter.
Correct, Your Honor.
So that's a difference that exists. There was no relationship here, right?
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
So, and then he went into the bedroom, and according to this then 12-year-old, sexually assaulted. If she was telling the truth, that amounted to a gross sexual imposition, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So he was charged with gross sexual imposition originally, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then, but that's not what he was held accountable to. He was allowed to plead to attempted felonious assault.
Correct,
to resolve
Your Honor.
That.
Yes, Your
and
Honor.
And that has nothing to do with gross sexual imposition, right? It's not a lesser included offense.
Correct, Your Honor.
So he never really was held accountable criminally. He wasn't held to a sexual registration requirement as a result of that criminal prosecution, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So is there really indicia, even if we accept the argument that there's enough similarity between the two, with that plea to something that a jury could never find, they could never hear those facts on a gross sexual imposition and come back and say, we think this is more an attempted felonious assault?
Well, Your Honor, you just said that the jury couldn't find. It was a plea, and we didn't introduce the other act's evidence, the fact of the conviction of the attempted felonious assault or the abduction, until the sexually violent predator specification portion of the trial. So with other act's evidence, we weren't introducing the fact of the conviction involving the stepdaughter. We introduced the other acts evidence, the testimony of the stepdaughter. And to do so, Your Honor, only requires substantial proof, which this court has held having the testimony of the victim themselves is enough to have as other acts evidence. There in 404B, there have been allowed other acts evidence that are uncharged conduct. There have been times, I know in State versus Smith, this court has already heard about acquittal conduct. So I don't think that that's an issue in this case, and I think that it was still permissible, even though he pled to attempted felonious assault and abduction, Your Honor.
Okay, so in getting back to Justice DeWine's question, you know, if you had, what specifically, what was it necessary for in this case under the rule 404B?
Was it necessary for?
Or did the state choose to advocate and persuade the judge that it was necessary?
For motive and intent, and even though they're treated separately, for intent, you have to prove specifically in this case for the burglary with the intent to commit rape inside of the hotel room, and that was needed to counteract the defense that was presented at trial that he went into the room to retrieve a bag, where if you have evidence that he has attacked.
What you're saying is that the other act, it's probative of his intent to commit a rape because he committed another rape. Isn't that exactly what 404 is supposed to prevent?
No, Your Honor, it's not that. It's the fact that when he's in the hotel room, he wants to commit, that his purpose is to commit the rape. And so I understand where you're thinking that we're using this as propensity evidence because of the fact that there's one sexual assault and another, but I think that this is the issue of why we're asking for clarification on Williams, and then also specifically we brought up for sexual assault cases because it appears to be a problem in the 8th District in terms of understanding the nature of why we need the evidence. When there's a consent defense, when there is, you need to be able to rebut the he said, she said, and present evidence of a specific course of conduct here. And there is a specific course of conduct when you consider the underlying reasons for sexual assault and for rape. And it's in this case, with a sleeping victim, it's targeting sleeping, vulnerable females.
So someone who's committed other rapes is more likely to commit more rapes.
No, Your Honor. I'm sorry, Your Honor. No, not just because of the fact that there was a prior sexual assault, but it's the manner in which it was done. So if you take it out of the sexual assault context, Your Honor, if you look at State versus Clinton that this court decided, you had
Now you're back to arguing an identity reason rather than a motive reason or an intent reason. So
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I think that
showing a plan here that he seeks out vulnerable victims who are sleeping, who are vulnerable and secluded.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's what you're trying to show here. And that's what the court didn't buy, but that's what you were trying.
By the court meaning the 8th District, correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
The trial court did find that. And I also would like to say before reserving the rest of my time for rebuttal, the 8th District only looked at the reasons that the state presented the evidence and did not look at what the trial court found the evidence to be permissible for. And the standard when regarding 404B evidence is an abuse of discretion, and the opinion clearly is focusing on just what the state was offering the evidence for and not the stated reasons that the trial court permitted the evidence to be introduced for. So the state believes that the 8th substituted its judgment for that of the trial court, and I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Madam Chief Justice, Associate Justices Joseph Patatus and Megan Patatus, on behalf of Appellee Mitchell Hartman. With the utmost respect to the state of Ohio, this court has answered the question that is currently before it in the second paragraph of Williams. The second paragraph of Williams starts out with that plan and intent may be admissible in certain circumstances. That's the first line of the second paragraph in Williams. What the state of Ohio seeks to do here is argue to this court that the 8th District erred in rejecting kind of the shifting sand arguments that they made. At the trial court level, this was entirely a behavioral fingerprint argument. The state of Ohio, I believe it's page 4 of the transcript, the prosecutor states, we're not offering this evidence because he's the type of person who commits these crimes, but rather we're offering this evidence because he is the one that committed the crime. They're not arguing that it was part of a plan or scheme. And in truth, before this court, it's plan and intent is the question. The state of Ohio, I know, argued extensively about mistake in their brief. They never argued mistake at the trial court level. They never argued mistake at the Court of Appeals argument. They forfeited that argument. They've never raised that before. They are, I believe, shifting and moving the target. And I think that goes to the fact that this is truly propensity evidence. The cases are so dissimilar. One is a 12-year-old. The other is a 22-year-old. The 12-year-old is a stepdaughter. The 22-year-old is a friend who is engaging in legal activity at a bar where alcohol is being consumed. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that Mr. Hartman acted with a plan in either case. There is no evidence of a plan. There's no...
So it was just opportunity.
It could have been opportunity if that is what the state had decided to argue, but the state, Your Honor, never...
Isn't it a little coincidental that both victims have been sleeping when they were attacked?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the testimony of EW in this case, she was not sleeping. She testified that she heard the door open. She heard someone come in the room. She thought it was her boyfriend. And when we look further at her testimony, she ended up arguing with her boyfriend, not because of something Mr. Hartman did, but because of, in her words, she was mad at something I did. The issue the state takes here is that we argued consent. But we didn't argue consent in the fact or in the sense of Mr. Hartman mistakenly thought he had consent, but rather, in this case, the evidence we believe showed that there was true consent. The mistake of fact defense was never raised here. This was not a mistake of fact affirmative defense. This was simply denying that force occurred. And I think that's an important distinction here, is that Mr. Hartman never advanced the theory, I thought there was consent and I was mistaken. The theory was that there was true consent. And if we look at the testimony of EW, she came very close to conceding that. And I think that's important when we look at plan. There's no plan. There's no evidence of a plan. There's no Mr. Hartman suggesting that she leave the bar. Mr. Hartman saying, hey, is it time to go? Or to the boyfriend, Chris, are you going to take her back to the hotel yet? It appears she simply left, and it could be argued it was opportunity, but the state never argued that. As far as intent, the cases are so, again, dissimilar. One involves purported conduct, the other involves purported contact. And as the Justice Donnelly points out, the first case was pled down after, and the record shows us, he passed a polygraph stating that he did not engage in that conduct. And that is in the record. And the conduct, again, here is so dissimilar that it should never have passed the second prong of the test we have here from Williams. Again, Williams guides us. We don't need clarification. We do not need a new rule to be written. Williams exists, and the Court of Appeals got it right when it evaluated the three factors. And I think the strongest argument we have is on the third factor. The prejudicial value here is extreme. The air was literally taken out of the room, and I said this at sentencing, the air was taken out of the room when the now 16-year-old former stepdaughter got on the stand and said, my stepdad, Mr. Hartman, touched me, made me touch him. And that touching had nothing to do with any fact that was in evidence or any fact that was being contested before that trial, before Mr. Hartman's trial involving EW. There was no similarities. There was no testimony that he did, there's no testimony that there was a plan. It was just simply he did this act. That's all the testimony was.
Excuse me. As to the prejudice, though, there was no challenge to the instruction that was given in the trial court, and isn't it presumed that that could have taken care of any prejudicial?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. If we look at paragraph 40 of the Court of Appeals decision, not only did I initially object to the 404B evidence being used at all, I objected to any instruction being given on it. I also renewed, or I should say Mr. Hartman, renewed his objections at the time the jury instructions were being read. I believe it's page 1096. I could be wrong on that exact site, but the judge instructs us to approach. He asks, are there any further objections? And it clearly lays out, not that haven't already been raised, referencing that I have already raised these objections. So I was properly renewing the objection to the jury instruction at that point. But even if even with the jury instruction that was read, the trial court had indicated in the beginning of the case that it was going to issue a tailored instruction, tailored to the evidence that was presented, and it never did. My comment in the record was merely saying that is the OJI instruction. There was no agreement to give the instruction. At that point, the trial court had already ruled. I objected on two occasions, and I did not believe it would be pertinent to keep approaching and telling the trial judge, Judge, I still object, when I believe that at that point the record had been made. I didn't want to act in defiance of the trial court. I had made my record. And again, when we look at the prejudice, though, even if a tailored instruction had been given here, it's not clear what the state of Ohio was offering it for. It's not clear if they were still seeking identity, because identity was never at issue. It was no doubt Mr. Hartman is the one who went into that hotel room. And as far as a plan goes, this has to be one of the single worst plans of all time. He called the person who's renting the room to get the key, actually gets a key from the front desk, and goes into the room. I mean, this to believe that this was being offered as a plan is not. The state of Ohio never advanced that theory at the trial court level that this was a plan. They merely said Mr. Hartman engaged in this sexual conduct with his 12-year-old stepdaughter. Here he is again. He engaged in that sexual conduct with EW, and that was their closing argument. Their closing argument was he did it with a 12-year-old, and look, he did it again here. There was no, we're offering this to prove that it was Mr. Hartman who went into the room. It was all conclusory. And because it was conclusory, that to me makes it completely propensity evidence. And the fact that they're unable to identify, both at the trial court level and then at the Court of Appeals level, and now before you, that they're unable to point to a single consistent, this is why we wanted to use it. It is almost as if, respectfully, the ends justify the means. We have this evidence. It's the prejudicial effect is overwhelming. Once the jury hears it, this case is over. And that's exactly what happened here. The last witness in the trial was the stepdaughter. And when she testified, that was the last thing they heard before deliberating. If I have no further questions, I thank you.
The state didn't bring up that this victim was 12 years old, did they?
No, Your Honor. That was going to be my first point. If anyone highlighted the age of the 404B victim in this case, it was Mr. Hartman's counsel. In closing argument, he focused on that this evidence is solely being used to, quote, dirty up my client. In response to that, our rebuttal closing argument, the prosecutor stated that the reason why the last witness, which was the 404B witness, was presented was that because we needed to prove the intent when he went into that room, and that it wasn't to grab a bag, but it was to rape the victim in this matter.
Did he have a bag in there?
He did, Your Honor. He did, and it was a bottle of liquor. A couple points I would just like to touch on that Mr. Hartman's counsel has misrepresented regarding the record. First, the objections that were made at trial regarding the 404B evidence was regarding the admission of the 404B evidence. It was not regarding the jury instruction or what should be part of the 404B evidence jury instruction. As stated in his appellee brief before the 8th District Court of Appeals, he took no issue with the jury instruction listing all of the purposes, and I can't quote it, but I believe in that appellee brief said that the instruction was proper. Regarding EW's testimony, it's completely a misrepresentation that she came close to conceding that this was a consensual encounter. All of the evidence, all of the testimony discussed how after she had called immediately her boyfriend and the girlfriend and the friend Stephanie and her boyfriend arrived on scene, she was shaking uncontrollably, she was crying. This was never consent, Your Honors, but that was the defense that was put forth. And that defense wasn't put forth until trial, which was during opening arguments when Mr. Patichu said, this is a case that turned from regret into rape.
Okay, but I guess her testimony was she thought it was her boyfriend.
Your Honor, and that was not only until Mr. Hartman's penis was already inside of her mouth.
I understand that. But that's now being construed as consent?
By the defense, yes. And then also, they also were presenting this defense with a video, surveillance video from the bar that they were actually interested in each other, that she was interested in Mr. Hartman, and the surveillance video counteracted any of that presentation or argument because there was no evidence presented by Mr. Hartman's counsel at the trial. And so it was all based on cross-examination and opening and closing arguments regarding what their defense was. I think it's important to note, and why this is part of our proposition, that intent and plan is admissible when identity is not at issue, is because of Williams. And I think that sometimes there's confusion, and I think the 8th District confused, in this case, plan with identity because of the phrases behavioral fingerprint and modus operandi. But as discussed in Williams, you can have an MO or a behavioral fingerprint when you're not looking at identity. It can go towards plan. And mistake was not part of the argument by the state.
So the act 4 years ago was part of the same common plan as this one?
It shows a course of conduct, yes, that they're targeting.
It's not a common plan, though, right? I mean, common plan is that these two acts are connected because they're part of the same plan. For example, a bank robber steals a gun before they rob the bank. That's a common plan. So common plan, you have to show that these are part of the same plan.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree. It's the same method. So I think that goes back to Williams, and that was the argument that was presented by Mr. Williams' counsel during the oral argument in front of the House Supreme Court, was that there has to be a link between the two acts. But that was rejected in Williams, and also the 8th District took issue in that was the case that came up to the House Supreme Court. They came up with the same conclusion based on State versus Curry, but Williams overruled that. And I think what it can be offered for, there's a wide range, and also that the trial court has great latitude and discretion to consider what the plan or method is that is at issue here. And I think what's important is to also focus on what the trial court said when admitting this evidence. And it's at a transcript page number 16 through 20. The trial court held its decision until the evidence in this matter was going to be presented, so it could see what the defense was going to be and what the evidence that was presented at trial. And so the comment by Mr. Hartman's counsel that having the other ex-evidence witness go last somehow makes it worse was actually planned that way to ensure that it could be reevaluated regarding the defense that was presented, the cross-examination of various witnesses, and what evidence the state presented, to then make sure that these are the permissible purposes that can be presented. And so the trial court found that the evidence that potentially was going to be presented was that the other ex evidence witness and the victim in this case is that he attacks vulnerable asleep victims, quote, vulnerable asleep victims, and isolates them and controls them. And, quote, it goes directly to several factors of the second part of the test. That is, this defendant's intention, his plan and scheme, and absence of mistake. And that direct quote is from transcript page number 18. And EW was asleep, and he knew that she was going to be asleep. And I'd also like to focus on the other act's testimony. I think it's important to point out the similarities between both acts here. And the testimony from his stepdaughter was that Mr. Hartman first came down on one night and said goodnight to her. And that's important because it establishes that he's saying goodbye, that she's now going to go to sleep, and so he knows that she's asleep, just like how he knows the victim in this case is asleep. Then he comes down again, and she's awoken by him touching her. And she says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "What are you doing?" And he leaves. The third time he comes down, and he touches her vagina. The important and leaves. The fourth time that it happens, she's pretending to be asleep. He believes she's asleep, and he pulls down his pants and takes out his penis and forces her to grab it. But that part of it is important to how it relates to the act in this case. It's because Mr. Hartman is using the victims when they're vulnerable and isolated for his own gratification and knows that they can be unable to resist and easily to be manipulated.
Counsel, you've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.